Hello everyone, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to season 6 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And as always, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
Today on Archive Fever, we are recording in Sydney on unceded Gadigal land, and we have a guest who once said to me about his work, "All I ever write about is male violence and the infantilizing effects of growing up in all male societies." Mark Dappin is a journalist, novelist, historian, and the author of 10 books, whose topics range from Vietnam veterans to prison breaks to armed robbers to Jewish Anzacs to collections of travel writing. His books have been short and long listed for the Miles Franklin, the Age Book of the Year, the Ned Kelly Awards for Crime Writing, and the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards for non-fiction. Mark is perhaps most known and loved for his long-running column for Good Weekend magazine, but also writes essays for literary magazines, as well as writing episodes of the television series Wolf Creek. He has a Bachelor of Social Science degree and a Master's in Journalism from UTS and a PhD from the Australian Defence Force Academy. One university professor who wrote a whole essay about Mark's writing of feature-length profiles said that he brings, quote, a gonzo rock and roll sensibility to his work and is, quote, admired for being an independent thinker with a quick wit. Because Mark is so multi-layered, like an onion or an ogre, there are many strands of his research practice we could unravel. But today we want to focus on his true crime writing, and particularly his latest book, Carnage, subtitled A Succulent Chinese Meal, Mr. Rent-A-Kill, and the Australian Manson Murders. Mark, watch your cock, and thank you so much for joining us today.
That's like the worst Cockney accent I've ever heard.
Well, you say it.
It's
you
so
do
extraordinarily
it, yeah.
bad. It's world class. Like some of my books, I take issue with some of the points you made in the introduction there. Yes, I mean, King of the Cross was shortlisted for the Ned Kelly Award before it won. Yeah, Nashua's War was also shortlisted for the Penn Literary Prize before it won one of them. I'm not always second best.
Mark Dappin's books have been short and long listed and won major literary awards in Australia.
You also seem to believe I've only got 3 degrees. I've got 4. I've also got a degree in history. I'm just saying, not that it's important, but if we are counting these things.
Well, I did get most of your biographical facts from your own website in which you interview yourself.
I do, but you see, I know these things.
So I should have just rung you up.
No, I don't need to ask myself in interview what degrees I've got because I'm aware because I passed them.
Well, then you should write.
That wasn't necessary to put on the website.
You should then write yourself a Wikipedia entry, please.
Well, we know what happened there, don't we? Or do we not?
Why don't you set us straight?
Why Wikipedia entry? I don't know who wrote it. And somehow, when it first appeared, my mum, God rest her soul, found it and read it. The first line of this Wikipedia entry, which I've no idea who wrote, said that when Mark was 10 years old, his mother left his father for the lodger and they went and lived together, something that Mark often writes about or sometimes writes about. I've no idea how my mum possibly could have found it on a computer, why she would have looked at my Wikipedia page, but she did. She rang me up and she said, "Ah, Mark, Wikipedia is calling me a slut." And I said, "Mum, everything in Wikipedia is rubbish. Everyone knows that." This was years and years ago. And then I set about to make everything in Wikipedia rubbish so my mum would believe it. So back in the day, I had the column, yeah? So I challenged readers of my column to vandalise my Wikipedia entry so that when my mum looked at it, she'd think every line was rubbish, not just the truth about what occurred in her marriage and indeed my upbringing. So first, because I'd recently been given the Australian Masters Sumo title by default because nobody turned up, including me, for the Masters. But I was the only person who was entered, even though I was on holiday in Queensland at the time and I've never trained sumo. So I was Australian Masters sumo champion. The readers started to give me other titles, other sporting titles. So that ended when I was given British slingshot champion. And then I was deported from Britain for using my slingshot to slaughter native wildlife. And when I got bored with this after a while, I was given acting roles. I was the dwarf inside R2-D2 in the original Star Wars. Then it became more eclectic. And honestly, mate, I know you know other contenders for this role, but my proudest moment, perhaps my proudest moment in my whole life, for about a week, I was, according to Wikipedia, Australia's first female prime minister.
Okay.
So, and you didn't mention any of that.
Next time I have the misfortune of having to introduce Mark Dappin in any forum, I will just say, today we have Mark Dappin. Some of his life is true, but most of it is rubbish.
Just say, today we have one of the contenders for the title of Australia's first female prime minister.
Okay, Mark, we'll get to carnage in a moment, which we are going to talk about. Let's go back to where your archive fever first began, all right? So as astute listeners might have deduced by now, you grew up in England. Is that where you first got bitten by the research bug?
I was thinking about this morning, and I was brought up to believe that sort of the greatest political virtues were municipal achievements, I suppose, public transport, public health, public libraries. Like, they were kind of worshipped in my house. All the things that gave working class people the same things as rich people considered the finest achievements of the body politic. And so my mum was very concerned to introduce us to libraries and books from when I was really little, which was, you know, I suspect it contributed a bit to the tension in the house because my dad left school at 14 and he couldn't read. My mum ended up teaching my dad to read, which perhaps part of the division that occurred between he and I was to do with these different levels of relationship to the written word. But yeah, I guess first it would have been Sheepscot Library in Leeds was the first place I browsed books. And I guess when I eventually came upon archives, I thought of them as like secret libraries, you know, libraries for the elite, and yet still, I suppose, open to the masses.
And what for you was the key that unlocked those secret libraries of archives? What drew you to them in the first place?
I think the first archive that I went into was the Modern Records Centre at the University of Warwick, where I did my social science degree. And they had a collection of anti-fascist material. I think back in the day it was English, British anti-fascist material predominantly. But I just looked at it for the first time since then. I looked this morning, I couldn't even remember it was called the Modern Records Centre this morning. And they seem to now have this massive collection of international anti-fascist material. But I used that for my undergraduate dissertation. And then when the dissertation was over, I continually went back to that archive when my degree was over because I was fascinated by the material.
And what does it feel like when you are in the grip of archive fever? I mean, we liken it somewhat facetiously to an addiction. Does that metaphor work for you?
Back then, I think the addiction was that I couldn't smoke there. I have a feeling that.
But you kept going back, so clearly there was something.
Yeah, I think you have an urge to continually build upon a knowledge base, like any academic project, I suppose, start to want to build incredibly detailed knowledge of an incredibly small subject, which you could only do with archival research, I thought back then. And I kept wanting to know more and more. And there wasn't really anybody to talk to particularly about it. So you end up, you know, in discourse or whatever with the archive itself, I suppose. So, you know, going back even once your relationship's over to try and come to a mutual agreement about what occurred. No, I don't mean that. Yeah.
And after you finished that initial degree, did you know you wanted to work in a field that would involve lots of research and allow you to keep kind of diving into these archival spaces.
Well, what happened next? My personal tutor said, all right, you've got to decide whether you're going to go out into the world or stay within these ivory towers, I think he said. And I said, stay within ivory towers, yep.
It's nice and comfortable in here.
Yeah, been to the world, it's rubbish. Although, you know, in favour, you can smoke there. So he said, oh, you'll get an MA grant. I didn't get a grant. I got placed and not a grant. I couldn't afford to stay otherwise. I was unemployed for quite a while. As a result, I became eligible for a long-term scheme for the unemployed to work as a community history worker as part of an art gallery, the Herbert Art Gallery and Museum. We were sort of outreach workers for the museum, but there was no actual work to do at all, nothing whatever. Then nobody ever came to the museum. It wasn't a proper job at all. But we were geared up to gather oral histories on behalf of community groups, none of which wanted us to do so. So I did become interested in oral history then. And probably for quite a while after that, when I finally got out of England and made a life for myself outside the ranks of the unemployed, I know I was still unemployed, I was travelling. Well, I started reading classics of oral history when we were travelling, like Children of Sanchez, the oral history biography of Norman Mailer and stuff. And I became much more interested in the idea of oral history and the potential of oral history, even though it had no potential when you actually tried to put it into practice because nobody wanted me to do it when I was paid to do so.
So that continued it on. And then you came to Australia. When did you arrive in Australia?
89.
And you worked as an editor for many years along the spectrum from subby to editor-in-chief for Women's Day, for the Australian Financial Review magazine, and possibly most infamously for Ralph, the Lads magazine. I want to know, Mark, what being a professional editor has brought to your work as a writer and a researcher?
Well, actually, when I started here, because I hadn't really done anything in England, yeah, I just had to lie. So I said I'd worked for 5 weeks on a free newspaper as an advertising salesperson, but I changed that for working 18 months there as the editor. So before the internet, so you could say what you wanted, really. So I got a job as a proofreader in a type shop based on this non-existent experience. But then the sort of proofreading arm of the operation collapsed, but they liked me, so they retrained me as a typesetter. A shit typesetter because, you know, what I could really do, I couldn't even type, actually. I taught myself to type over Christmas. Then typesetting itself kind of collapsed. Every industry I join collapses. So good luck with podcasting, because I've done two already. Yeah, so typesetting collapsed, but it collapsed because of the advent of desktop publishing in publishing. When newspaper sub-editors were first introduced to desktop publishing programs, they were suspicious of them and didn't understand them, whereas because they were based on typesetting, I did understand them. And so I moved kind of almost seamlessly from typesetter to sub-editor. So it was more kind of graphic experience and layout and typographical experience that I brought to editing at a level that really very few sub-editors had in Australia. And I've forgotten your question.
It's all right. I wasn't a very good one in the first place.
No, I speak not.
In 2014, Mark, you were commissioned by the Centenary of Anzac Jewish Program to write a military history book, Jewish Anzacs. It was published by the Sydney Jewish Museum. I'm curious to know how you walk the line between commissioned history writing, especially on a topic with such a high sacred cow rating as Anzac-centric military history. How did you square that with being in this independent thinker that you're supposed to be, but now I just actually don't believe anything that anybody says about you?
Well, I'd pick you up on sacred cow. I mean, I believe that's a Hindu term. Doesn't it refer to Hindus, doesn't it?
Yeah,
could you work it? Give me more kosher.
Okay.
I know you can do it.
This cow that has seen a moil once in its life.
A circumcised cow.
Okay, can we get back to the question?
Yeah, it was boring. How did I feel about that? I had thought, and I had said to them that I would take it on only if there's no editorial interference. The archival part of that book, the majority of the archival research found fruition in a final section which kind of named every single Jewish serviceman ever in the Australian Armed Forces. I didn't do that. But that was the sort of record book aspect, the apologia aspect of the work. So what I wanted to do, even then, I had this idea that you could tell the story of the Jewish military presence in Australia, or the presence of Jewish Australians in armies, it turned out to be, armies, navies and air forces, through their own testimony. I didn't anticipate any level of analysis at all. It was just going to be a historical narrative of Jewish people's involvement in the military from their arrival in Australia to today. In the end, it became apparent that it had to have a degree of theoretical backbone, but it wasn't really pushed upon me. The people who had commissioned it didn't have any particular idea. I think they thought that simply showing that Jewish people had served was an end in itself. The whole idea of that kind of apologetic text is probably more militarist than I would otherwise be comfortable with. But on the other hand, I wanted to do it. I wanted to do the research. I wanted to understand the experiences of some of these people. And I understood the kind of historical precedence of the Jew lists in the German army in the First World War, and the kind of importance of saying, you know, Jewish people or gay people or whatever, indigenous people, also contributed. Our history is not only made by white Anglo-Celtic males.
So it was part of the add Jews and stir to the bathwater rather than tip it out version that you say have the book that you've just about to release.
Why would you stir the bathwater? Why would you stir the bathwater?
Well, you assume that the Jewish people were there in the general milieu. You got to mix it in.
And also not is to leave a ring around the tub.
Are we in a mikveh here?
Should we move on to carnage?
Yeah. Well, I want to ask first before we get, you know, Claire in her introduction said that you'd said to her, Mark, on a previous occasion that all your work is about male violence.
I think I said all I write about really is. Yeah.
Yeah. How did that become your subject of choice?
I think it was going to school. When my mum really did leave my dad for the lodger, who she later married, we moved from Leeds to a garrison town in the south of England called Aldershot. As you go into Aldershot, it's a big sign saying you are now entering Aldershot, home of the British Army. Most of the facilities in town were military facilities. The main road out of town was actually a military road subject to military jurisdiction rather than civvy police. And the army were a huge presence there at the same time as there were a massive presence in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. So Aldershot had been bombed during the Troubles, and bombed Guildford, which down the road was bombed, I think, just before I moved there. I don't think I lived there at the time. The IRA were often after the paras. So the paratroop regiment were on constant rotation, 2 and 3 para were on constant rotation to Northern Ireland 4 months at a time. Then back in Aldershot, what they did in Belfast, they did in Aldershot too. So it was a very violent town, if that's what you were looking for, if that's what you were looking at. The town centre was dominated by paras, although there were many other logistics units of other regiments based in Aldershot. They would not go into para pubs. And so there was this kind of exclusively male social geography imposed on any entertainment area in the town. In the cinemas, in the nightclubs, in the pubs, and it was a stratified geography. Don't I sound clever? I've never quite thought of it.
Yeah, I love this.
It's as if I'd written about
whole male social geography. Sounds great.
Stratified is an excellent word. Yeah.
Thank you. I think I probably learned it off you. You've got no women at all. So what you had is really the social relations of the playground reproduced in the town. The toughest kids, the sporty kids, logistics are almost the nerdy kids in the army. I don't think there's anyone quite as nerdy as us speaking here now in the British Army. But So there's this all around me. And there was the school that I went to was quite rare at the time in that it was a state comprehensive school, but it was all boys. I suspect in part because of the sort of social history of the town. And, you know, they called you by your surname. They're obsessed that you're wearing uniform all the time. At the top of the school, there's no interest in educating you at all. It was all about trying to keep order. Mm-hmm. I mean, that interested me as well. Like, I'd been to an ordinary comprehensive school before that, and it was fine. Like, people learned stuff. And
you operated as a school, you know, yeah.
Yeah, people could read and all kinds of things. And then you go to a garrison town. And, like, it was... They, you know, a lot of people did building studies. Like, people on the third and fourth bands at my school couldn't read. They did building studies. Every year they built this concrete shed thing in the playground and then knocked it down so the next people could build another one. So school really puzzled me and changed the way I looked at life ever since. And I came away from that. But I think I was in many ways conditioned by that environment. And it's not like... I don't know, I've never thought about the way it affected me before, and I don't think you asked me, but I thought it's more interesting to talk about myself.
Always.
Oh, yeah, only if it's me, though.
Mark, how did it affect you?
How did it affect me,
going
Claire?
Going to that particular school in that particular garrison town?
Well, that's a good question, Claire, finally. I don't know, but it certainly seems to continually play out in my subconscious. You know, I write about jails and armies, and I think a lot about hierarchies that are based essentially on skill with violence and stupidity.
Let's now talk about the archives of violence, then. Let's move to Carnage, your latest book.
I should say something else to that. I loved growing up. I loved school. 14 to 16 was one of the best times in my life. It was fantastic being at that school, but you didn't learn anything.
So it wasn't a traumatic experience. It was just a kind of curious experience.
It was just interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it had traumatic aspects.
Yeah.
but no, not in the sense that you imply.
Can we move on to Carnage now?
I suppose.
For fuck's sake. Your latest book.
It's sort of about me. Yeah.
This is your latest book to delve into the heart of criminal darkness. And this time it's about baritone larrikin Jack Carlson, who was arrested outside a Chinese restaurant in Brisbane in 1991. And the research journey to write this story ultimately leads you from being a reporter to a detective, in a way. Carnage is described on the cover by the novelist Robert Drew as true crime at its grim and richly entertaining best, and let's face it, its truest. So there's a trinity of praises there, and I'd like to take each one separately. True crime at its grim best. Can you tell us firstly what makes this story grim and how you came to be its teller?
I think the horror at its heart is not what I expected to find. It wasn't my idea to write the book. I received a phone call from a man who I didn't know, a number I didn't recognise, who spoke as... G'day, my son. My name is Jack Carlson. I understand you're writing a book about prison escapes. You should include my own adventures in your tome, or something like that. And I think, who's this? But quite often lunatics ring me up with strange propositions, like, for instance, when you asked me to go on this show. I said, no, I've just finished the book, mate, but thanks for calling that. And he said, nonetheless, you must come and visit me. I must tell you about my own escapes from custody. They are manifold. And I'm going, yeah, maybe. And then I got on the bus and I got a phone call from this other bloke I know who's a former maximum security prisoner at Pentridge. And he said, I'm sorry, I didn't tell you. I gave your number to Jack Carlson. He's the most interesting crim you'll ever meet. So I went up to see Jack. Eventually, I was on holiday up near where he lived, and I went to his house, and he started telling me the story of his escapes, and then he said, and then my wife got murdered. And once he told me that his wife got murdered, it was the first time I realised who he was. I knew that a woman called Eve Carlson had been the first victim of a series of gangland murders in Melbourne in the late 70s, but I hadn't connected that with Jack Carlson, and nobody had said that to me. So the horror at the heart of the book is the murder of his wife, then the murder of the person who murdered his wife, then the murder of the person who supplied the guns for the murder of the person who had murdered him, then the murder of the person who his wife had been murdered for initially freeing from jail, then the murder of that person and the murder of the person that murdered them, I think. I might have put one too many murders in there.
I reckon I counted six, maybe seven.
There's actually 17 in the book.
Oh, okay.
But some of them are kind of peripheral murders or tangential murders.
This is the house that Jack built.
Yeah. But no, it had nothing to do with Jack, really. He happened to intersect with some of those people in the, both the world and the underworld, and they happened to murder his wife. It wasn't Jack's responsibility or Jack's fault.
So the story came to you via Jack.
Yeah.
Is researching true crime kind of like the archival equivalent of crack cocaine, like the really hard stuff?
I suspect it might be. What I wanted to do when I first started to write these true crime books, because Carnage is my third, is tell the stories of these people, A, in their own words, and B, to try and explain their values as they were supposedly held and actually lived. I've always wondered what bad guys' stories are like from a bad guy's point of view. I mean, we can all, you know, express contempt and repulsion for people who do evil things, but I wanted to know how people who do evil things, I guess, live with them themselves. So first I wanted to gather kind of oral histories. I wanted to speak to them about how they lived their lives and how they felt about what they'd done. But my doctoral supervisor, the late Jeffrey Gray, said any time you use an oral history, I want you to triangulate it. I want you to find a document that substantiates it and one other person. So it was sometimes easy to find the other person and a lot more difficult to find the documents, but not impossible. With Carnage, Jack actually had some his trial transcripts. Although I now realise I could have got them, the New South Wales State Records Office keep a massive number of trial transcripts, fascinating bound volumes of trials, but not particularly well indexed. So he had them, so I had an archival source to cross-check. The problem with Jack is he went by at least eight different names, so it's difficult to trace. But newspapers weren't as useful as they might be for other people because I never had any idea what he was calling himself when. When I found a reference to Jack or one of his cohorts in something that was obviously true, an archival source that's obviously correct, yeah, it's a massive hit. It's like, yeah, it happened, it happened. I can write this.
Mark, it strikes me that particularly if you're triangulating and you have to corroborate something that you've been told, and maybe you've been told it by a criminal person or a bad guy, as you've just called them, are you concerned that when you eventually write something, your archives might talk back to you, or even more specifically, your archives might shoot you in the knees?
No, I'm not concerned at all. As the chronicler, you're in their world, but you're not a part of it. You know, criminals really, apart from their partner and their immediate family, they attack each other.
What if you say something they don't like? You found a piece of evidence that doesn't corroborate the story or the version of themselves that they wanted to tell, and then you write that.
Once, with the first book, I wrote something contemptuous about someone I hadn't met who was dead, a violent criminal, and I was approached by two people about that, both of them more in sorrow than anger. Said you shouldn't say that about him, he was a good bloke. And, you know, based on his actions, he was not. But I've come to realise a lot of people are actually their best selves in jail. So they knew a good man. I corrected it. I took out the contempt in the e-book. I didn't know him. He didn't kill anyone. I actually feel I should not have used the language that I did. But beyond that, I don't even know if they really read them. They're not allowed true crime in jail. They're not allowed them in the libraries.
Has Jack read Carnage? I mean, it's the book that he started by ringing you up and saying you should write about me.
He has read Carnage, yeah.
Mark, reading Carnage, you know, which, as we've been saying, is populated by some pretty unattractive, violent characters, I was really struck by how many of them, almost all of them, seem to have experienced childhoods in institutional care where they experienced, you know, pretty horrific physical and sexual abuse.
It seems like you're kind of often narrating this pipeline from institutional care to juvenile detention to adult prison. If we take it as true that there is that pipeline, is the kind of the underworld you're documenting in this book and in your other ones, is it kind of an archive of childhood trauma in a way?
Yes, it is. But again, to further, these institutions are all male. Once again, so they actually start off in abusive all-male institutions, being abused by figures of authority who really, you know, have clearly graduated to that position so as to exercise their sadistic impulses on the most powerless. And I think when you do that to people, it does seem that they often develop similar attitudes. They normalize that for them. That's how they think you grow up. You grow up with that, you think that's the right way, you think hierarchy is determined by violence, and you become a violent, abusive person yourself. What is interesting, though, is the archives of care. Somebody, not for this project, and in fact it was a woman who was a prison escapee, asked for her reports from juvie and showed me them. And I wish I had more of that kind of stuff, but it's hard to get if you're not that person or next of kin. I tried to get juvie reports for Jack's wife, but the family member of his who was trying to help me didn't even have the necessary documents for her own, never mind the mother's. So there is a formal archive of this abuse. There are personal files that are available.
There's been a whole Royal Commission based on them.
Yeah. I don't mean the files of complaints. I mean the files of continual meetings with psychologists and social workers and stuff that describe people's journeys through the juvenile justice system. Not of the horror of the abuse, but I guess of the day-to-day workings of the system that did abuse, that otherwise abuse them, probably with the abuse actually pulled out and put back into the narrative by the Royal Commission.
Going back to that Robert Drew puff on your book about this is true crime at its truest, what makes your true crime truer than others in the genre? And flipping that, what would false crime writing look like? What would make it illegitimate or fake crime writing?
I mean, the Chopper books aren't true. Most criminals don't admit to murders that they have done. Chopper Reed created a new kind of criminal persona that admits to murders he hadn't committed. A lot of them do gather other people's stories and make them their own. But it's almost a legitimate part of an oral tradition when they do it. And I suspect they almost come to believe it did happen to them, especially things in jail where everything's happening to everyone and pretty much you're leading the same life anyway. So some of the books, I guess, aren't strictly true because they're transcribed stories from an oral tradition. You could have anybody at the centre of it. And some of them aren't true because somebody's found out that if they tell a really spectacular story, they'll sell a larger number of books if they can be funny with it. But that's not to say that certainly the first Chopper Reed book is meritless, or even those oral tradition ones are, but I wanted to do one that was academically rigorous, at the same time tried to tell the story from the viewpoint of the perpetrator. Now, whether that was actually a worthwhile project, I don't know anymore. It puts the perpetrator above the victim. I realised that while I was writing it. I read, I think, what Eve Wilde wrote about that. And she made a very good moral case. And towards the end, I began to doubt, A, whether it was possible to explain the way the perpetrators thought, and B, whether I do think it's desirable, but whether it was really the most moral way to look at the story.
Is there anything that you've ever seen in your archival journeys through criminal records or with criminals that you, I know you can't reveal your sources, but is there anything you've ever seen that you wished you could unsee?
Yeah, I spoke about one of them in the book in the end. You're very lucky in Victoria in that coroner's records are open to you. Virtually, I think, all inquest records prior to 83 are open. And most of the victims of the murders in Carnage were killed before 83. And the inquest coroner's records are very, very comprehensive documents. It's not only is that a transcript of the hearing, but there's also ordnance survey maps show with little crosses where the bodies are found. There's often criminal histories of the people who are being considered as possible culprits. And I should say as well, the fascinating thing for me was the discovery of something called body cards, which are pre-inquest files that often contain depositions that aren't called at the inquest, but also contain police-written biographies of the dead person. Anyway, these were available to me, but it was during the pandemic and I couldn't get them myself, so I got somebody else I know in St Kilda to go and photograph them for me. He said, do you want to see the crime scene photos? I didn't really understand what it would add to it. And I have seen crime scene photos before and they're just boring. They're a picture of fat men pointing at things, which is all right.
That's what you're into. Yeah.
Yeah. But then when pandemic lifted, I went back and looked at the files myself. And I was talking to a guy who used to run a nightclub where a police officer called Brian Murphy, a notorious Melbourne detective, informally provided security. And this guy said Murphy had taken him to look at the crime scene photos of a woman who had been murdered. It was called the Body in the Loft murder. I think it was in St Kilda, to sicken him. Although the body in the loft was only in the story because this guy said Murphy had shown him the file, I went and looked at that file and I looked at those pictures and they show a woman split basically from crotch to neck. I didn't realise, I don't know, it just never occurred to me that's where it would be there and that's what it would look like. And then later, the final victim of the gangland killings, again a woman who was taken up a dirt track and raped and stabbed 120 times and I don't find quite hard to talk about this. It's just the third time I tried. But the fact that the corpse was surrounded by beer bowls, like it was a pie, just sort of disgusted me. It disgusted me that. When I was researching, I put out on social media, there's some sort of Facebook sites for people who love nightlife in Melbourne in the 70s and 80s. Who have frequented the nightclubs that some of these people did. And they're saying, leave it alone, forget it. No one wants to know. These people are scum. And then I look at that and thought, they were right, really. They were right. I shouldn't have done it. Not even I shouldn't have done it, but why is it worth preserving the memory of their life over anyone else's, you know? That particular image, it's not impossible. It doesn't traumatise me or anything, but it was a kind of a moral awakening.
Is it worth doing it to preserve the dignity of the victim in some way? Restore the dignity of the victim?
Well, if I could have got more of the victim's story, it would have. She in particular was a very difficult person to find out much about. Like previously she'd been in Cooper Pedy living with a opal miner or whatever. If I were to do it again, which I don't think I will, I would try even harder because I did try to include the stories of the victims that didn't make it seem as though the climax of the triumph of their life was being murdered. But, you know, I'm still conflicted about it. Even now I'm thinking anyone can do that. Maybe it is useful for humanity to understand what the murderers were thinking, what they thought they were doing, and how they became those people. Maybe.
It's a fascinating discussion about the ethical use of archives, and we have it across a number of fields, and this is a very different field, but thematically we've been here before
in certain
ways. Yeah, and it's
the question of, you know, whose stories get told and what purpose does that telling serve?
Yeah. It strikes me as well, I mean, we've talked to other people, Eve, about when they've, particularly First Nations people, when they've had access to archives that they shouldn't have seen, that there are ways in which they have to make themselves culturally safe afterwards and cleanse themselves. And I'm not sure whether there are any rituals for you to cleanse yourself post viewing the Archives of Violence, Mark, but I hope that you are safe.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us, Mark. It's been a real pleasure.
To learn more about Mark's work, you can visit his website, markdappin.com. You can read his interviews with himself. Both Carnage and his new book coming out in 2024 called Lest are published by Simon & Schuster, and they will be out to purchase at your favourite local independent bookstore.
You can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at Eve_Rees. You can't follow Mark on any social media because he's far too sensible to do that nonsense. Don't forget that you can catch up on all of seasons 1, 2, 3, 4 and 5 via the website archivefeverpod.com. And you can also listen and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen.
So, until our next therapeutic session, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Coming up on the next episode.
Even if they check all those boxes, you're not just going to receive this evidence from anywhere. There's going to be just people in the past who you'll never be able to know for sure.